we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
British opposition Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn is accused of not tackling anti-Semitism in the party. Corbyn's apologised for his support of the creative and anti-Semitic mural, but Britain's Jewish community isn't satisfied.
The Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn was forced to apologise after seeming to express his agreement several years ago for the sentiments in the mural. His apparent sympathy for Hamas in Gaza also enraged part of the Jewish lobby.
Mr. Speaker, I've been a robust critic of the actions of the Russian government for more than 20 years.
And I was not intending to intervene in this, but I cannot actually let that remark go by. I've sat here reading his article in the Morning Star after Russia annexed part of Ukraine, where the strongest criticism he makes there is, on Ukraine, I would not condone Russian behaviour or expansion, but it is not unprovoked. And then into the usual criticism of the US and NATO and UK policy. It's just not true, Madam Deputy Speaker.
The leader of the Labour Party in Britain, Jeremy Corbyn, is being subjected to one of the most vicious and mendacious political witch hunts ever mounted against a political figure in the history of British politics. It is a witch hunt that began the very day he was first elected as the most unlikely leader of the opposition possible to imagine in 2015, propelling him from the backbenches where he languished in relative obscurity for decades into the political spotlight and mainstream, along with values and political beliefs that stand as an existential threat to a status quo dripping in injustice at home and abroad. It is a witch hunt that has since reached a level of intensity which, to my mind, places his physical safety in danger. I say this sincerely and without exaggeration. Not satisfied with the entirely false smear carried in the UK corporate press at the end of February that Corbyn had been recruited by a Soviet Czech spy in the 1980s, the Labour leader more recently was subjected to dog's abuse in the pages of said corporate press over his failure to fall into line behind the government's narrative on the poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter in Salisbury. By way of a reminder, this is an official narrative which thus far is based on evidence-free assertion and supposition by said government and establishment for whom Russia's very existence constitutes a threat not to Western security as fatuously and continuously claimed, but to Western hegemony. The latest, and to my mind most pernicious salvo in this Get Corbyn witch hunt surrounds the sensitive issue of anti-Semitism, with the accusation that it is rife among his supporters on the left of the UK political spectrum. What we are dealing with here is an entirely synthetic and specious attack on a man whose entire political life has been dedicated to the cause of anti-racism. It is anti-Semitism being wielded as a sword at a time when the international campaign of boycott, divestment and sanctions, otherwise known as BDS, against Israel's apparatus of apartheid, under which the Palestinians have been suffering for far too long, has never enjoyed more support and traction in Britain and across the world. And don't take my word for it either. Listen instead to the sentiments of Jewish Voice for Labour, a pro-Corbyn group of Jewish activists within the Labour Party, which issued the following statement in defence of the Labour leader on this issue. The statement reads in part, "We are Jews in the Labour Party currently actively campaigning for Labour in local elections. We are appalled by the actions and statements of the Board of Deputies, which is the mainstream leadership of the Jewish community in the UK. They do not represent us or the many Jews in the party who share Jeremy Corbyn's vision for social justice and fairness. Jeremy's consistent commitment to anti-racism is all the more needed now. As the British people call time on May and the Tories," the statement goes on, "they are getting more desperate. We would hope that any organisation claiming to represent Jews would be calling them to account. The statement goes on to assert that the aforementioned Board of Deputies also says nothing on the global rise of the far right and the toxic anti-immigrant rhetoric of the tabloid press, despite the imperative from Jewish history to speak out against racism and fascism. End statement. Now, anyone with an ounce of awareness and understanding could only concur with this statement, and anyone with an understanding of history can but, when it comes to Corbyn's demonization, call to mind the sage and timeless words of Malcolm X. Quote, "If you're not careful, the newspapers will have you hating the people being oppressed and loving the people doing the oppressing." I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, joining me on the line, I have Mary Dajewski. She is a writer and broadcaster, and she's delighted to come on board. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, just before I bring you in, Mary, let me set my cards on the table. I am not speaking as an unfailing supporter of Jeremy Corbyn. Indeed, I did not vote for Labour in the last election in 2017. I have profound differences with Jeremy Corbyn when it comes to the issue of Brexit. I think his position on Brexit has been both wrong-headed and muddle-headed. I am not a member of the Labour Party, but I am appalled at the scale of this witch hunt and the trajectory that it is currently on. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I agree with quite a lot of what you said, because I am also not a Corbyn supporter in the sense of his politics. His politics aren't mine. But I would say from the time that he stood as Labour leader, and it has to be said, I mean, he was forced to face not one but two leadership contests, both of which he won. From then on, and particularly at the last election, it seemed to me that he was treated very, very unfairly by the mainstream media in the UK. And I'm actually on record several times as saying that in columns. On the one hand, I don't support a lot of his politics. On the other hand, the way that his election campaign was covered, and the way that some of his policies are covered, and more to the point, at least during the election campaign, the way they weren't covered, seemed to me that it was really not a level playing field. But then, of course, that rather rebounded in his favour, because he attracted a lot of the anti-establishment vote. So in a way, simply by being on the one hand ignored, on the other hand vilified by the mainstream media, that actually gave him additional support. And I think that's one of the big reasons why he did so relatively well in the last election.
Indeed. Now, the catalyst for this latest salvo, as I said, is on the issue of anti-Semitism, was a wall mural that appeared in East London in 2012. And the artist of the wall mural was a friend of Jeremy Corbyn's on Facebook. And the wall mural was forced to be taken down. It was clearly and horrifically anti-Semitic in tone and in imagery and in depiction, involving an anti-Semitic image of Jewish bankers getting rich on the backs of the poor and the working class. This is an anti-Semitic trope. There is no doubt about it. Now, Jeremy Corbyn responded to said artist's lament that he was being forced to take down the wall mural. And to my mind, it should never have been allowed to appear in the first place, but that's another story. And Jeremy Corbyn responded by saying, well, you're in good company, because Diego Rivera's wall mural was taken down by Rockefeller because it included an image of Lenin. And so there's been a cri de coeur unleashed. This has been uncovered. Maybe they were sitting on it, his enemies in the press and in the political establishment, waiting for an opportune moment. Maybe they think this is it, on the back of Owen Smith, a member of his shadow cabinet, who was the person who challenged him for the leadership back in 2016 on the issue of Brexit and who lost resoundingly. Jeremy Corbyn said that he was unaware when he saw the wall mural that it was anti-Semitic. He only looked at it briefly. I think most fair people accept that. Nobody accepts that Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite. But the issue that his enemies are focused on is the fact that there's a lot of anti-Semites in the Labour Party and among his supporters, and he's not treated this issue as seriously as he should have. Your thoughts on that, please, Mary?
I find this very difficult to judge because I think that if you are Jewish in the UK at the moment, you do feel that there's a climate which is quite hostile to Jews in general and to ethnic minorities, further ethnic and religious minorities across the board. But of course, because I think Jews in the UK have generally been not only quite successful, but have integrated very well and have felt themselves to be part of the overall community, that what they feel is the is an upsurge in anti-Semitism, say, over, well, they would probably say, especially since the Brexit vote. The way that Jeremy Corbyn is being presented as anti-Semitic is playing into this this particular sentiment.
Indeed. I mean, but I do stress the point that the Jewish voices that are attacking Jeremy Corbyn on this issue are not speaking for the entire Jewish community.
No, this is true.
That's where I align my... yes.
And you have, as you said in the in your statement, you have the Board of Deputies who have come out very strongly against Jeremy Corbyn. And then there are his supporters, including the Labour Party, who have come out in his support, saying he's absolutely... You know, the idea that he's at all anti-Semitic is completely misguided because he's been a wholehearted supporter of equality, equal rights, anti-racism, supporting full rights for minorities of all varieties. So, no, I mean, it's fair to say that opinion is split. And there's a demonstration on Parliament Square this week, which was actually two demonstrations. The majority was anti-Jeremy Corbyn, but there was also quite a decent turnout from people who said that the campaign against him was wrong and that he wasn't anti-Semitic.
It's a very sensitive issue, obviously, Mary. Anti-Semitism, we understand the history. It is the most vile species of racism, responsible for repeated pogroms against Jewish people, particularly in Europe, in Eastern Europe, culminating in the Holocaust in the 1940s, during which 6 million Jewish people were slaughtered for no other reason than they were Jewish. So no one should dismiss the legitimate fears of Jewish people. And I'm speaking here as a non-Jew, and it's easy for me to sit back and make a judgment. I'm not. I am aligning myself with the voices of the Jewish Voices for Labour, who are Jewish, and they're just as Jewish as those who are opposed to Jeremy Corbyn. But you rightly say the issue is split. I think the context to this is key. I like to think that if there was an upsurge in anti-Semitism in this country and the lives of Jewish people were under threat, I like to think I'd be one of the first on the barricades defending the Jewish community. But I do think that the context to this is clear. As I said in the intro, we've had an unremitting campaign of demonisation against Corbyn because I think of his politics, particularly, I would suggest, on foreign policy, because as you know, if Corbyn comes to power in Downing Street, then the whole array of UK foreign policy alliances, which have been the bedrock of UK foreign policy for many, many years, the Atlantic Alliance with the US, the alliance with and support for Israel, UK membership of NATO, Trident, all these would come under threat, certainly in the eyes of his detractors. Your thoughts on that aspect?
No, I mean, I think that is certainly true. And I also think that since the election, one of the sticks that has been wielded against Corbyn is the idea that he's anti-patriotic and he's basically a traitor to British interests.
Mary, can I just stop you there? I'm sorry, we've run right up to the break. We'll continue this after the break. You're listening to Mary Dejewski. This is Hard Facts. We'll be right back.
We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with writer and broadcaster Mary Dejewski, and we're discussing the campaign of demonisation and witch hunt against Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn. At least to my mind, it's a campaign of demonisation and a political witch hunt. Sorry, Mary, we were talking about Corbyn's foreign policy and how it's perceived as a threat.
I think that, I mean, you're certainly right that obviously if Corbyn were to become Prime Minister and if he had the majority of his MPs behind him, which is not necessarily the same thing, then there would be some quite significant changes in foreign policy. But it seems to me that in the short term, some of his foreign policy stances have been picked out to illustrate, to present him, not primarily as a threat to UK interests, but personally as a traitor and a betrayer of the national interest. And we saw that. I mean, I was very, very surprised. Immediately after the poisoning in Salisbury of the two Russians, there was a statement in the House of Commons. Theresa May announced her what she was going to, her initial steps. And then Corbyn gave his speech where he accepted that it was entirely likely that Russia was the culprit. But he also said that there was maybe room for a bit of consideration, a bit of greater consideration of the facts and a bit more investigation before jumping to conclusions. And in saying that, he was booed in the House of Commons, including by people on his own side. And he was presented in the papers the next day as a Kremlin stooge. Now, I happen to agree with Jeremy Corbyn on this, and I still think that the British government has jumped to conclusions, that it's put politics and diplomacy, as it would see it, ahead of working through international organizations and conducting an investigation. And the actual evidence for Russian and especially Russian state culpability in the poisoning in Salisbury is, to my mind, not proven. We certainly haven't, the British public has not been presented with anything like evidence, let alone conclusive evidence to that effect. Corbyn has actually gone a bit further than I would go in appearing to accept that Russia did it.
Yes, and he also supported the recent expulsion of Russian diplomats from the UK, which I think was a mistake on his part. Obviously, since then, we've had the mass expulsion of Russian officials and diplomats, particularly from the US and also from various EU member states.
Yes. Corbyn's getting no credit. I mean, Corbyn is getting no credit from having altered his positions slightly. He's still being presented as sort of not sufficiently enthusiastic in support of the anti-Russian campaign.
And the thing is, Mary, they cannot abstract the history of Iraq from this issue, which they seem to be trying to do. As I've made the point, when they're not trying to have us forget the last war, they're trying to shape public opinion in support of the next war. And I recall that statement by Theresa May and the booing and the hissing and the horrible, vicious, mendacious atmosphere that was whipped up against Corbyn for, as you say, daring to ask the most tepid and rational of questions regarding this case. It had chilling echoes of 1914. In the run-up to the First World War, the jingoism, especially in the feral news media in the UK, and this is where I think Theresa May was acting opportunistically, because obviously her government, up to this point, has been mired in crisis over Brexit. It's no secret that her cabinet is split on the issue of Brexit. And from the day that Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia were poisoned, a heinous crime by anybody's measure, the press jumped to judgment, rushed to judgment, stampeded to judgment, and blamed Russia immediately without any evidence. And I do believe that Theresa May was bounced in some ways into taking this strong position that it was Russia by this feral media, fearing the wrath of this media if she dared to hesitate in doing so.
Well, I'm probably a little bit more sceptical about the actual power and pressure exerted by the British press, because it seemed to me that in, as it were, focusing on the likelihood, as it was presented, of Russian responsibility. On the very first day, Boris Johnson was giving a statement, and he didn't immediately target Russia, but he implied that. And of course, all that was needed for the majority in the British press to get hold of that line and run with it. The government really didn't need to say anything more at all, and I think it knew that. It knew that it was actually triggering an anti-Russian campaign that it would then be able to capitalise on by taking the measures that it was taking. And I think the lack of almost any scepticism in the British media. There's even less scepticism about this than there was, say, over Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. And I think that when you look at the world of politics and the media, you see that there is this huge consensus really now built on this anti-Russian campaign. But I'm not sure how much conviction it carries in, as it were, the grassroots. Because what I think there's quite a difference between the what you see in what we now call the mainstream media, and among politicians, and what you listen to, if you listen to phone-ins, including in mainstream media, if you read what people write under press commentaries, you find much, much more scepticism. And of course, what then happens is people turn around and say, "Oh, well, you know, it's the Russian bots who are putting out this line." But actually, the scepticism of, I would say, quite a large, it's very difficult to judge, but quite a large proportion of the British public about the official line on Russian blame for the poisoning in Salisbury. I would say there's a lot more criticism and scepticism at grassroots level than there is in the mainstream, whether it's politics or the media. And I think this is a bit of a problem for the government, or it could be.
Yeah, I think it's down to the mantra, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. People are not ready to be fooled again or be marched lockstep into another confrontation. After all, we're not talking a confrontation in this instance with Iraq after 13 years of sanctions in 2003. We're talking Russia. It's beyond belief, Mary, that these, I would call them fanatics, these neocon fanatics are engaged in this campaign to demonise Russia to the extent that conflict is a real prospect at this stage. It's a real prospect. And here's Jeremy Corbyn, who's anti-war to the marrow of his bones. He has been proven right time and time again on foreign policy, unlike his detractors in Parliament and in the pages of the media that is currently excoriating him. I really fear for Jeremy Corbyn, Mary. I fear for his physical safety. I can only imagine the stress he's under right now. He's only a human being, and yet he's been dehumanised, stripped of all humanity. And as you say, a projection of the anti-Russian animus in this country is being heaped on him for daring to not to be as gung-ho as the government and other members of his own party when it comes to following this anti-Russia narrative. If you were him right now, Mary, what would you be thinking about your place in politics and about the state of our democracy?
Well, I think he's probably made of rather sterner stuff than you're suggesting, because I think his whole life really has been as somebody campaigning against the establishment. And one of the things that came out at the last election was that he is a very, very experienced, very accomplished campaigner. And this is what separated him from the Prime Minister, Theresa May. He was just much better at that part of politics. So I think that in a way, being as isolated as he seems, or as vilified as he seems by a large section of the establishment, I mean, for him, he probably turns around and says, well, you know, that's life. That's how it's always been, and that's how it carries on, even though he's now leader of the opposition. But I think he would be entirely justified in turning round and asking, you know, what does it take to be leader of a genuine opposition in the UK today? Not an opposition that sort of lines up behind the government when against their beliefs, but actually challenges the government and questions them, and asks for evidence for the judgments that they've reached. Now, you know, my view is that that is actually what an opposition ought to be doing, but apparently that's now, at the moment, in current circumstances, that's considered deeply unpatriotic and dangerous.
Do you think Jeremy will survive this period, Mary? I'm not convinced that he will. I mean, this the intensity of attack on him right now, involving all spectrum of party politics, specifically and lamentably and shamefully, to my mind, members of his own party, the PLP, that is. Do you think he will survive this? And if he doesn't survive, what do you think will happen next? Who do you think will take his place?
I have no idea what will happen next. At the moment, I think he probably will survive. But if he doesn't survive, then it will be his removal as Labour Party leader will be, it'll go through the Labour Party procedures. It'll be an internal coup against him. It won't be, there may be all sorts of actors sort of egging the anti-Corbyn Labourites on from the sidelines. But if it happens, it'll happen from inside the party, not from outside.
Now, Mary, we've already explored the threat that Jeremy Corbyn poses on the issue of foreign policy to the status quo, but he also clearly poses a threat when it comes to the economy. He advocates a redistributive politics which puts the focus back on the working class, working people who have suffered grievously under a status quo of unfettered free market economic doctrine introduced into this country by one Margaret Thatcher. And I think Jeremy Corbyn's economic policy can best be summed up in the following quote, and it goes like this: "These unhappy times call for the building of plans that build from the bottom up and not from the top down, that put their faith once more in the forgotten man at the bottom of the economic pyramid." Now, this statement was not written by Karl Marx, was not written by Lenin or any other socialist revolutionary or radical. Its statement was made by one Franklin D. Roosevelt in the 1930s as part of a radio address, Franklin D. Roosevelt being considered one of the greatest presidents in US political history. That is the politics that Jeremy Corbyn stands for. That is the fairness that he advocates. And that is one of the main reasons they hate him so much. You've been listening to Mary Dajewski. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.